And it's 21 and a half past the hour on a Tuesday morning, election day here in the U.S. of A. And for you folks in Europe, you can just sit back and watch the circus as it happens before your very eyes and ears and tune in to, on the Internet and see whether we come out the same country tomorrow that we are today. We'll see. David Allen Punt, our newsruminator, is with us. And joining us now from Garden Valley, Texas, Dr. Don Clark, biochemist, a vigneron. That means he grows grapes. He's on his grape branch down there in Texas. And also a member of the Board of Creation Moments. And Don, this is a topic we've kind of talked about before, different aspects of water. And as a biochemist, I imagine you're intimately familiar with water. And as a vigneron, you're primarily concerned with water, aren't you?
Well, yes, especially during the hot summers, you need to at least keep enough water on the vines to to keep them happy. Otherwise, they sometimes don't do very well, especially here in East Texas, where we've got all kinds of disease pressure.
Yeah.
So keeping the vines happy is very important, and water is an integral part of that.
And I was so fortunate to we drove about the 200 miles up to Garden Valley and visited Don's winery this weekend, my wife and I, and saw his sophisticated watering system. He has a pond, and it has pipes from the pond pumped up through a system to his various sections of vines, and it's under precise control. And you even have sensors in the ground, don't you, to tell you what the water level is like there. Huh? The moisture content.
We do have, yeah. Yes, we have moisture sensors, and when the moisture level gets below a certain level, then the irrigation system comes on.
That's pretty astounding,
and
I think.
The waters the vines.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, automation is the key when you have so many things to do and not enough manpower to do everything.
Yeah, we learned. Don gave us a great primer on wine growing and how complex it really is. Not just growing the grapes, but what you do with them afterwards. And but water is where it starts. And Don, the Greeks had this idea that there's, I don't remember all, air was one of the elements, fire was one of the basic elements, water was another one. It's almost like fire and water were opposites. And this article that we're looking at this morning from The New Scientist suggests to me that if we were a ball of burning rock when the Earth formed, how could there be any water here at all? Where'd it come from?
Well, that has stumped scientists for a long time as to where the water came from, because the traditional thinking is that, okay, we had the sun starting to form, and then we had these gases kind of swirling around, and then planets kind of coalesced out of the gases, or even from the material that was around, and then everything was very hot for a very long time. And then things started to cool down, and then voila, we have our planet and all the planets that we see today. This explanation's not very cogent for a number of reasons, and one main reason is because, look, we can see a lot of water on the surface of the Earth.
Yeah, I've noticed that, yeah.
Yeah, and so this water is very important to life, and we couldn't have had life without the water that we have here. So we've got a dilemma, if you will, a dichotomy. So something must have happened in the early part of the formation of the Earth that water kind of stuck around, maybe. Or maybe it was here before even the sun and the moon were here. Because part of the theory as to how the Earth formed and the moon formed was that there was this big, bigger moon, if you will, that struck the Earth, and which became our smaller moon, and our moon's pretty good size, and that left some moon material on Earth and left some, but vaporized anything that, was around. And would have vaporized any water that would have been around if that theory is indeed correct.
Mm-hmm.
And the first article that we are talking about suggests that when you read through the whole article and you give all these explanations as to, gee, well, you know, this theory doesn't work out. This theory doesn't work out because of things would be too hot, or the moon striking the Earth would cause the water to vaporize, and some other people do some calculations that show, well, you know, maybe the Earth had enough gravitational pull to pull that water vapor back down to Earth. And it leaves you with the impression that, gee, there's a lot of guessing going on here, and not a lot of, concrete science. And the science that's being done is we've got, minute differences in the ratio of, for example, hydrogen and deuterium in the water that we, find on Earth versus the water that's in the moon. And maybe it was this way, or maybe it was that way. But no really concrete conclusions.
Well, they have some readings of water in out in space, don't they? I mean, they have some chemical formulation, some idea of how that water is composed, and it's apparently different from the water here.
Well, the water out in space is heavier water, and what I mean by that is that it's the hydrogen to deuterium ratio, or the deuterium to the hydrogen ratio, let's put it that way, is much larger for the water that's out in space than the water that we find here on Earth. Several hypotheses was the way water got here in the first place was that there were icy asteroids that struck the Earth, and that's where the water came from. Well, if that's true, then we should see a much higher ratio of deuterium to hydrogen of the water here on Earth, and we don't see that. So that hypothesis kind of goes out the window. And eventually the author of the first paper that you sent suggests that, at least 70% of the water had to be here before the Earth formed. And we hypothesized that maybe it was here before the sun was formed, which is an interesting conclusion, because this guy may be coming close to the biblical explanation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if we, go back to Genesis, we like to go back to Genesis a lot, because Genesis, talks about this. Now, it doesn't talk about it in detail, but it talks about it enough that you can get a picture as to what happened when and what was the sequence of events. So in Genesis 1:6, it says, "And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so." So Genesis says that water was there at the beginning. God created the waters first. And so if you go to Genesis 1:9, it says, "God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so, and God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good." So here we have that the rocks and the hard substance, which we call earth, we call Earth the whole Earth, but here God, calls Earth the dry part of the land on our Earth, and the gathering together of the waters he calls seas, which gives us a picture of, all the land was in one place and all the waters were in one place in the early part of Earth's history. And since this is Genesis 1:9 that we're talking about, this happened before the formation of the sun and the moon and the stars and everything, terrestrial, I mean, not terrestrial, but, you know, out in space. So the waters were there before the sun was there. And it gives us a completely different picture of how the waters got here. Matter of fact, the waters were here before everything else was formed. And if we look closely enough, we should see that the Earth is primarily is made up of a lot of water, because it said that the Earth was separated from the waters. And so there had to be, there was the water first, and then the Earth, or the minerals and everything, were formed after the water. Now, that brings up your second article, which we've talked about before, is that the waters, there, you know, there have been studies, and now it appears to be, you know, pretty much verified that there is more water under the Earth's crust than there is on top of the Earth's crust. In keeping with the biblical record, interestingly enough, that there is at least three times more water under the Earth's crust than there is on top of the Earth's crust. Well, you know, this is a interesting find, and those of us who believe in the Genesis account of creation say, well, you know, of course there's more water under there than there is from, you know, on top of the ground. And even in Genesis 17, for example, we read that this is, you know, during the time of the great flood, on the very day that Noah and his sons and Ham went into, well, wait a minute, let's go back. Let's go to in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of heaven were opened. So that meant that not only did it rain for 40 days and 40 nights,
it'd be the windows of heaven,
Water was coming from the great deep. So the great deep being what? Well, you know, water was coming from the ground and also covering the earth. So it was coming up from the ground. So even the water that we see today, it was less in the past than it was than it is now. And more water came up from the great deep at the time of the great flood in Noah's time. Than there was, you know, before that time. So these two articles tied together actually describe what's described in the biblical record, you know, more accurately than any of the other hypotheses these folks can come up with.
You know, that there would be that much water under our feet is a pretty amazing thing to think about. Probably, we know about aquifers and wells and drinking water. But this article says that three times the volume of all the oceans has been discovered beneath the Earth's surface. And they're talking, 700 kilometers. That's 420 miles under our feet is where that water is, locked up in a blue rock called ringwoodite. And I never heard of that. Have you?
No, I haven't. But it apparently is a highly hydrated, you know, mineral that has a lot of water bound to it. Now, the water is not necessarily, you know, free like we have on the surface of the earth, but it's bound up. And there were some studies several years ago done by a creation scientist named Hugh Humphreys that suggested very strongly that our magnetic field, and we've talked about this before too, that our magnetic field couldn't be explained other than the Earth had to start as a ball of water. And because water, as we know, has a dipole moment, so each water molecule acts like a little magnet. And that's why it sticks, you know, to itself quite well, is because of the dipole moment that's that, you know, is made up. So it's like you can think of little water molecules as little dipole moment. Well, when these kind of line up, it created at the beginning this, and you know, if the water is spinning, it created this magnetic field that we have around the Earth today. And we know, based on studies, that the magnetic field of the Earth has been degrading over time. And if we take that the degradation rate and look back into history, we find that there would be nothing on the planet that could survive the magnetic field greater than 10,000 years ago. Suggesting that, well, either everything started at least, you know, no later than 10,000 years ago, which, of course, is the creation, you know, hypothesis or theory, if you will, or that no living things could have survived, you know, greater than 10,000 years ago. Either way, we're looking at a very young, you know, planet. And we're looking at, more importantly, that there are no other explanations, at least no other good explanations, for our magnetic field around, you know, around the Earth than suggesting that the Earth started as a water ball. And, of course, this the second study saying that there's more water under the planet's crust than there is on top of it would corroborate that finding as well.
And they're talking about using 2,000 seismometers and testing this theory. Reading seismic waves generated by more than 500 earthquakes as they make the Earth ring like a bell for days afterwards. And he attributes that in part to this massive amount of water in the rocks. Wouldn't it be interesting, and you probably, I can't believe this has not been done, but to start with a biblical story and try to disprove it rather than not consult it at all. Wouldn't that make more sense?
It would, you know, make more sense, or at least, you know, to say, hey, we've done these studies. Let's see, you know, according to the biblical model, there should be a lot of water around under our feet, and let's do a study to see if water is there, instead of coming from the other perspective, the evolutionary perspective that says that everything started as a hot ball of fire, which, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, you know, no water could have possibly existed. So we've got this thing turned all upside down because we just refuse to look at the Bible and see what the biblical record says, the biblical historic record, by the way, as opposed to, oh, that's just a bunch of myths and, you know, it has no validity. Well, what we're finding is that, you know, the science correctly interpreted reinforces what the Bible says, and that the Bible's explanation as to how everything came into existence is far more satisfying than anything that man can come up with.
You know, this kind of ties in with an article that David and I were discussing earlier on something called the hive mind. Have you heard of that concept, Don?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, there was a physicist in India, this was 1999, who decided to do an experiment, and he put a computer out in a slum in New Delhi, and then just observed the behavior of people around this computer. Remember, this is 1999, and the first thing it did was attract kids, who then started manipulating this computer, which they had never seen. It was a totally unfamiliar piece of equipment to them, but after days, the physicist came back, and they had learned how to surf the internet by that time. And these were young minds, these were young children, and he's since researched this phenomenon, and he calls it basically the hive mind, where if you can get a group of kids together from the age of 8 to 12 and just leave them on their own with access to the computer, they're figuring out quantum mechanics. They're way ahead of the peer group in school taught by teachers in the standard way. So I'm thinking that maybe there's a pattern here of human behavior and how the Genesis came to be, it's information drawn from the collective mind of humanity, inspired by the Holy Spirit at some point, you know, prodded and pushed, but that there is a collective memory in the human race with bits and pieces of the origin story coming from all different directions that come together nicely in Genesis, and maybe we should pay more attention to it.
Well, I think we would do well to pay attention to the early, you know, biblical record as to how things came about. I mean, God thought it was important to tell us, and to, you know, when he created Adam and made Eve from Adam, that man would understand where we came from, because it's an important question. I mean, you know, we're searching. Science has gone away from the Bible because, oh, we don't want to contaminate science with theology or with religion. And so we've got to make up stories that, you know, describe our origin from an extra-biblical perspective. But when we do that, we come up with explanations that just, you know, don't make sense, and with the things that we see around us. So coming back to the Bible, there's nothing wrong with looking at, if this was any other, you know, the book or ancient writing, if, you know, we had the perspective that, hey, forget about the religious aspect of this, if you will, and just look at this as a history book. And this is a description as to how the earth was formed from the very beginning. Do we gain any insight by looking at it from that perspective? And of course, the answer is, well, yes, we gain some insight, and it helps to explain the world around us.
Excellent point. Talking with Dr. Don Clark, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, I want to point out their website to you. It's creationmoments.com, and Creation Moments exists for the purpose of collecting and disseminating scientific information that supports the biblical creation story. And it's a wonderful website. Again, you can link to it from our site, brokenroadradio.com. This to the right-hand side of the homepage there. Click on it. It'll take you to creationmoments.com. Have a look. And Dr. Don, as always, we appreciate your wisdom, your insights, and thank you for joining us today. Look forward to next week.
All right. Very good. You have a great week as well.
You too. Bye-bye.
So long.
Bye, Don.